It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is out today. Coming up, House Speaker John Boehner will be leaving his congressional seat at the end of October. We'll find out what that means for the GOP, for Congress, and what prompted his decision. First, it's time for a weekly Wisconsin news roundup. Governor Scott Walker made big headlines this week when he announced on Monday that he'd suspend his presidential campaign, and the state legislature is in the news as the Senate and Assembly held their first session since July. Joining us now to talk about all this is Jesse Apoyan, the state government and politics reporter for the Capital Times. Jesse, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Rob.
Well, let's harken back. It seems like a long time ago already. Here's Governor Scott Walker suspending his campaign on Monday.
Today, I believe that I'm being called to lead by helping to clear the field in this race so that a positive conservative message can rise to the top of the field. With this in mind, I will suspend my campaign immediately.
People thought this might be coming sometime, but this was kind of a surprise when it happened Monday, wasn't it, Jesse?
Oh, it definitely was. Yeah, I mean, we started to see his poll numbers drop in the last few months and really tank in the days leading up. It was the day before he announced he would drop out that his numbers were, he was an asterisk, right? So it was like less than 0.5%, which I think amounts in that sample to between 1 in 4 people saying he was their top choice. So there was definitely talk of what was going to come next. Was there going to be a shakeup in staff? How was he going to refocus his operation? But I don't think anyone was expecting him to pull the plug so soon.
You mentioned bad numbers with a percentage sign in front of them. There are also worries about bad numbers with dollar signs in front of them.
That's right. His campaign manager was getting a lot of criticism for just running such an expensive and expansive operation, for starting things big from the get-go. You know, they had, I think, 90 people on staff. They had a full-time photographer. They had a consultant to reach out to evangelical groups, and just sort of a, you know, lavish-looking sets every time he was talking anywhere. So it was a very professional-looking campaign. It looked like the campaign of a nominee and not a primary candidate. But, you know, as Donald Trump got in, as other people started to do well, the donations stopped flowing in, and you know, there's a cash flow problem.
Well, here at home now, we don't have a governor/presidential candidate. We just have a governor again. What was the response you've seen in your reporting through the week to this announcement and to Governor Walker being just the governor again?
Just the governor. I think there was initial surprise, but sort of the predictable responses on both party lines. You know, Republicans have, you know, at least on their face, been pretty excited to have him back, talking about getting right to work and, you know, getting back to work, that is. And Democrats are saying, oh, this is a sign that his, you know, his policies are being rejected, that his agenda is being rejected. And I guess there's some consensus all around that he's got to do a little bit of fence mending, just since he hasn't really been around that much.
And then questions were being asked as soon as Monday evening about will he serve his term? Will he run again? Will he end up in D.C. but as a cabinet member? What do we know, if anything, that we didn't know Monday evening?
It's still a little unclear. It sounds like he's saying he's definitely not interested in running for the Senate, not interested in a cabinet position. He says it's too soon to talk about vice presidential potential. It's too soon to talk about whether he'll endorse any of his former opponents. But he does say he wants to serve out his term, and he's not talking yet about whether he would run for another one.
Talking to Jesse Apoyan from the Capital Times about the big news stories of the week here in Wisconsin. And let's visit the state legislature, Jesse, back in session this week. A Senate committee held hearing on a couple of bills, assembly work on these two, a ban on fetal tissue research. What can you tell me about the bill they're working on and where that's going?
Sure. That bill would ban research being conducted on fetal tissue obtained from abortions. So it wouldn't touch fetal tissue coming from a miscarriage or something like that, but it specifically relates to abortions. It's gone through an assembly committee. It's kind of held up in the Senate right now, and the assembly is not voting on it, not bringing it to the floor right now. Leadership says the votes aren't there. Definitely some concerns from the research community and the business community. University of Wisconsin is opposed to it in terms of just the research that they do, and a lot of biotech companies are opposed to it, which means some of the heavy hitters like Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce are actually stepping up and opposing it.
Some related legislation targeting Planned Parenthood, both of these kind of stemming from videos that have been out there in the national news. The Assembly passed a bill cutting off not state funding, which had been cut off, but federal funding that goes through the state to Planned Parenthood. So what would that mean if it also went through the Senate and got signed by the governor?
So that bill would prevent Planned Parenthood or any other entity that provides abortions from receiving federal Title X funds. So those are money that goes to reproductive health services, STD screenings, things like that. So it would first direct it to public health programs like county health departments or the Wisconsin Well Women Program, and if there's anything left over, the rest would then go to nonprofits, but could not go to Planned Parenthood, which is the organization that has been receiving it for pretty much the majority of its existence.
As I mentioned, the Assembly passed this bill just yesterday. Is the Senate expected to take it up anytime soon?
There's talk. It sounds like that's likely. Don't have a timeline yet, though.
And then also this week we got news about the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, and a lot of times adjectives like troubled or embattled or beleaguered appear before that name. A report showed that the agency gave out more economic development awards this year with less results in terms of job creation. What's the buzz on this Economic Development Corporation, or WEDIC as it's commonly known, this week?
Yeah, and that's you're right. It seems to always have one of those taglines attached to it. Right now, the talk is just about the fact that they're giving out more. I think about $90 million more in awards this year than they did last year, but they'll be creating a few thousand less jobs or retaining as many. I guess the line on that is that it's less interest in some tax credits that are being phased out. Some of that money is also from a historic rehabilitation tax credit that was expanded a couple years ago. Obviously, the Democratic argument on that is that the taxpayers are not getting enough bang for their buck from the organization.
With a steady trickle of bad news or accusations about WEDIC, listening sessions on economic development kicking off this week, is there a thought that something's going to change? Either it's going to be severely tweaked or maybe even scrapped and they'll try something new?
Well, Democrats definitely want to do that. They've talked about pretty much dropping the current model, and they've got some ideas for how they might replace it. I think Republicans are a little shy of completely walking away from it. You don't want to give the impression that this is completely unstable or insecure, but I think most everyone is open to at least talking about what changes could be made.
Jesse, thanks as always for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That was State Capitol reporter Jesse Appoint of the Capitol Times giving us the latest on state news in our Wisconsin News Roundup. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. House Speaker John Boehner announced today that he will be leaving his congressional seat at the end of October. Joining us to discuss this surprising turn of events is Lily Gorin, professor of politics and global studies at Carroll University. Lily, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, this doesn't seem like a snap decision sort of thing, but here's John Boehner talking about how he made it.
This morning I woke up and walked up to Starbucks as usual and got my coffee and came back and read and walked up to Pete's Diner and saw everybody at Pete's and got home and thought, yep, I think today's the day.
So I said this is a surprise. Seems like it was a surprise to everybody but John Boehner. I mean, but there was some thought, I think, that he might leave at some point. How surprised were you, Lily?
I was pretty surprised. I have to tell you, I was out and about this morning, and I looked down at my phone, and there was the headline from the New York Times that John Boehner is resigning, you know, from his seat and from the speakership in October.
So what's the story here? What was behind this decision, the conflict coming up over the budget? that was going to lead to a leadership challenge, right?
Yeah, I mean, each one of these points where he's had to, sort of muster the troops and get either continuing resolution through or budget through or some sort of deal through that's going to either not, sort of tank the economy or keep, the doors of the government open. He's also had to deal with the right flank of the Republican caucus in the House, who continuously have been threatening him in his speakership during the whole period that he has been speaker, that they're going to try to, overthrow him. And the first couple times, he was mostly able to beat it back. But at a certain point, I think he's also become more and more frustrated that he has this sort of perpetual problem in trying to do his job as Speaker of the House, which is also leading the House. I mean, it is leading the sort of the political majority in the House, which is the Republicans, but he's also a constitutional official. He is the Speaker of the House, and as such, his job to some degree is to lead the business of the House of Representatives.
And you talked about that a little in making this decision. Here he is.
It's become clear to me that this prolonged leadership turmoil would do irreparable harm to the institution.
So that institutional role you were talking about there, but this doesn't mean that there isn't going to be prolonged leadership turmoil because now somebody has to replace him.
Right. And so what you're going to see, in the next month or so, as he's sort of winding down, and we will probably move forward with some sort of continuing resolution to keep the government open in the near term or the immediate term, is that there is a lot of now sort of jockeying. He did give the sort of acknowledgement that Kevin McCarthy, who's a Republican House member from California, is likely to be lead the charge as the next speaker. But then everybody else who's sort of in other leadership positions will be moving around and jockeying for position, moving up, as it were. But there may also be some other challenges to either McCarthy or others for leadership positions from some of the more, sort of more conservative wings of the Republican caucus as well.
And we had scenes like Marco Rubio talking to a conservative group. And when he announced, he mentioned that Boehner left, cheers broke out. There are a lot of people, core Republican supporters, hoping to get somebody more conservative than John Boehner in that spot.
Yeah, and Kevin McCarthy is definitely probably more conservative than John Boehner, also hasn't been in the House as long as Boehner, which means he may not have as many, allies or colleagues to draw on if he needs to. But it also means that he may be more appealing to some of the folks who are, sort of looking for the outsider, even though all the people who are inside the House would technically be insiders, but somebody who is to some degree more outside of the establishment, sort of ruling group in Washington, D.C.
One name people were throwing around for the new leadership position was Paul Ryan. The person who owns that name, Paul Ryan, said, nope, no thanks, not going to do it.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by Ryan's response. I mean, right now being Speaker of the House with the Republican sort of fissures within the Republican caucus, it's a tough job, and that's also not necessarily always been Ryan's interest in terms of sort of bringing together the various wings of the party within the establishment itself, within the House itself. There was a lot of anticipation, of course, that Eric Cantor, the former representative from Virginia, who was the majority leader under Boehner, would have ascended to the speakership at some point in the near future. But then Boehner lost his seat in a primary challenge in Virginia last year, and so he wasn't even on the ticket in November last year to run for re-election because he had lost in the primary.
So Cantor was out, obviously no longer an option. We're talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University about today's surprise announcement from John Boehner, Speaker, soon to be former Speaker of the House of Representatives, soon to be former Congressman, too. Let's get into some of the response, Lily. Here's President Obama first praising John Boehner during a press conference today.
John Boehner is a good man. He is a patriot. He cares deeply about the House, an institution in which he's served for a long time. He cares about his constituents, and he cares about America.
All right, let's go to part two now, criticizing Boehner's GOP colleagues.
Speaker Boehner sometimes had a tough position because there were members in his caucus who saw compromise of any sort as weakness or betrayal.
One thing that probably won't happen, I think, Lily, is a spirit of compromise prevailing between President Obama and whoever John Boehner's replacement is as Speaker. Things aren't going to get any easier for them, are they?
I don't think so. And you know, there's been sort of a lot of discussion, at least in my Twitter feed today, about, you know, sort of the Boehner era. While we look at it sort of as we were in it as a time of a lot of disputes and these sort of cliffhangers with regard to keeping the government open or going over the fiscal cliff, that may actually be a calm look if as we enter the next 2 years, or the last sort of 2 years of the Obama administration.
Let's talk about John Boehner himself. Let's start at the end here. Hearing him talk, you know, I was over at Starbucks and thought, he sounds like a guy who just quit a job that was stressing him out and he felt great about being done with it, didn't he?
I think so, you know, and I think that there's been a lot of discussion about the fact that John Boehner has been working for a long time in the House of Representatives to invite a pope to the House to speak to Congress. And, you know, yesterday the Pope spoke to the Congress. He had, you know, a little time alone, a little conversation with the Pope. He was clearly very moved by the Pope's speech, if you saw any of it. And that, you know, he'd sort of accomplished a lot of what he'd gone to Washington in many ways to do. And he's been in Washington for quite some time. And he's, you know, he's not necessarily a sort of guy who's looking for a lot of marquee. He's, you know, he sort of was trying to do his job. He was elected by a pretty conservative district in Cincinnati, just sort of in Ohio. And he's really been trying to, you know, do what the people who elected him sent him to Washington to do. And along the road, he's sort of risen in the ranks and became Speaker of the House, which is no small accomplishment. And during that time, he's really had to struggle to keep his party in the House of Representatives together to govern. And, you know, the citizens don't necessarily like it when they see that the government isn't able to govern.
And he found himself in a position where, with this shutdown showdown, if his leadership position was challenged, he probably was only going to survive if Democrats rallied behind him to keep him in the office. Is that part of why maybe he gives up now? That would look bad for a Republican leader to need the Democrats to keep him on board?
Well, I mean, this has sort of been the case on a number of the pieces of legislation that had to get through, and the only way he could get them through on occasion had been with Democratic support, which is in, quote, violation of the Hastert rule, which was that you don't try to push anything through that you don't have the majority of your majority voting on, in favor of. And so it's been a difficult speakership for Boehner. And, you know, I do think he felt like, you know, I got the Pope, he came, I feel like I'm at peace with what I've done in my political career. And he's had a lot of headaches while he's been in the speakership.
And not just leaving the speakership, but leaving Congress completely. That, I don't know, maybe once you've run the place, you don't want to just be sitting on a bench somewhere?
I think so. I mean, you've seen that happen to some of the other folks. I mean, obviously, Newt Gingrich, when he was no longer Speaker, he was also potentially in trouble with regard to some ethics violations. But you also saw that with Hastert, when it was clear that Hastert wasn't going to be Speaker anymore. He also resigned. And even, you know, in Cantor, case where he was defeated in the primary, he actually resigned before the end of his term. And so to some degree, yes, if you're not going to run the place after you've run it, it might be just time to step away.
We've had a stretch of time now with a Democratic president, a Republican speaker, a lot of clashing, not a lot getting done. Some people look back on the time of Ronald Reagan, a Republican president, Tip O'Neill, Democratic House speaker. People very strong in their ideology on opposite sides, and yet they came together. They worked in a friendly way and they got things done. Is that wishful thinking that that could happen again?
Well, I think on some level it's not necessarily wishful thinking, but there are any number of now elected representatives who were sent, who campaigned on and were sent to office to basically sort of say, we're only going to do what we want to do and we're not necessarily going to compromise. And the system that we have, which is, you know, these sort of separation of checks and balances, separation of powers, I was talking about this with my students yesterday, and designed by James Madison 200 years ago, is one where you actually have to make some compromises in order to govern. That's what it is. It's not a parliamentary system where if you're the winning party, you can just start enacting policy. And as a result of that, we have difficulties when we have on either the left or the right groups of elected representatives who basically say no compromise. If you say no compromise in a Madisonian system, it kind of grinds to a halt. And Reagan was willing to make some compromises.
Will we see compromise within the Republican caucus in the House to come up with a leader? Or do you think this is going to be an acrimonious process to get John Boehner's successor in place?
I don't know if it will be acrimonious. And part of that will be that we're not necessarily going to see some of that sort of back and forth, because that's going to be within the caucus itself and it won't be public. But if people start leaking information to the media, then we may hear a little bit more if it's going smoothly or if there are actually fights going on with regard to support for either McCarthy or some of the other possibilities.
Lily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Lily Gorin, professor of politics and global studies at Carroll University. She joined us from our WPR studios in Milwaukee. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. If and when we need a nurse's care in a hospital, it might be for just one visit or for a day or on and off for months, depending on the situation that brings us to the hospital. But we just see a small piece of what that nurse is doing during a shift that routinely lasts 12 hours. In her new book, our next guest takes us behind the scenes and gives us the full picture, drawing on one day in the hematology and oncology ward of a Pennsylvania hospital. Teresa Brown is a registered nurse, a frequent New York Times contributor, and the author of the new book, The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. Teresa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Teresa, one theme that really struck me throughout the book, as you wake up in the morning through your day, your shift is this long string of routines and procedures, tests and check-ins, but at any moment, something terrible can happen, a life or death crisis for a patient. How do you work like that? How does that affect you day in and day out?
Yeah, it is. Well, I talk about a friend of mine said when she first started working as a nurse on my floor, she would drive to work and sometimes have to stop to throw up on her way there because she felt such intense anxiety. So I think we do it partly by gritting our teeth, partly by staying on our toes, partly by trying to enjoy it when things are going well. And the more experience you gain, the more you learn that the other nurses are there for you also, so you're not alone if something goes wrong. And that helps, but it can be tough. It can be hard.
I want to walk in the door with you here at the start of your shift. When you get your patients for the day assigned to you, when you get the handoff information, how does that work? What actually happens?
Well, we have papers for each patient, and they're always lying face down. And so in the book, I say that picking them up is like picking up a poker hand that I've been dealt, and I never know, am I going to get a royal flush or am I going to get a mess? Usually it's somewhere in the middle, but because we have a lot of long-term patients, we tend to know them pretty well, and you kind of get a sense of what is going to be on your plate once you see those names. So there's always a sense of pleasant anticipation, sometimes dread, sometimes both.
For any given patient, walk us through what you might do with them, related to them, about them over that 12-hour shift.
Right. So let's pick one of the patients I wrote about, Dorothy, who's been in the hospital for a long time and is getting ready to go home, we hope. So for her, that means a lot of paperwork has to get done. I have to give her things to collect up her belongings. Then my patient Sheila has a lot of intense pain. So my main issue with her is keeping her medicated for pain, but also explaining to her what's going on with her, because it turns out we misdiagnosed her and she keeps getting bad news. So there's a lot of emotional work that has to go on with helping her just to understand where things are and, as much as possible, feel a little bit less afraid. And then I have my patient, Mr. Hampton, who's getting very toxic chemotherapy drugs. So for him, that involves all the work of reviewing the chemotherapy order, double-checking the arithmetic that the physician did, having another nurse check it, get it to the pharmacy, and then many more checks once pharmacy gives me the actual drug. And then he has to be monitored very carefully while he's getting the drug, at least at the very start.
Talking to Teresa Brown. She's a registered nurse and author of the new book, The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. You mentioned the emotional work, Teresa. Talk about the emotional work you do with patients and of course, their families who are often there with you.
Right. The nurse is really the person there who has time to be with the patient, unlike MDs who, say when they're rounding, they come in, they're there for 5, 10, 15 minutes, and then they leave. The nurse is available, and so we try to be there for people when they're upset, when they need more explanation about what's going on. So there's a moment in the book when my patient Sheila has just gotten some pretty dire news about the odds for the surgery that she's going to need, and her sister is very upset, and she's very upset, and they're kind of upset for different reasons. Sheila's very worried. The sister feels like the surgeon shouldn't have been so blunt. And I realize they need someone to sit down with them and talk with them and say, not everything's going to be okay, because I can't promise them that, but here's what I can tell you. You have a very good doctor. You will probably go down for surgery around this time in the evening. I can't say when, but it will be after this happens and this happens and this happens. And being there for people can make a huge difference to them.
It's clear as you write about these patients, the one who just showed up that night, the ones who you've seen in and out of the hospital maybe for months, you feel attached, emotionally connected to them. That develops quickly.
It really does. It's amazing how quickly it happens, and it's something I really love about the job, but it can be hard when things don't go well. I remember a patient who came in, not a patient in the book, but it was newly admitted, new diagnosis of leukemia, and I felt like I'd been a nurse long enough that I'd sort of developed a callus of cynicism and didn't let people get right into my heart right away, but I was wrong. And I remember saying with this patient, wow, I really feel like I wish I had a magic wand and I could just make the disease go away. I don't know why that particular person drew that out in me. Just some impulse in me wanted to make everything better for him, and it was so frustrating that I couldn't do that.
I want to talk about one of the patients there that night on the shift in the book. You didn't actually draw his card, but he was somebody everybody was attached to, a punk rock firefighter. Can you talk about why tell us his story and your connection to him?
Yeah, well, I've stayed in touch with him and his wife, and they signed a release form and read a copy of the manuscript and gave me permission to tell his story, even though they are identified with pseudonyms. I really wanted to put him in the book in some way because he defies everyone's expectations, I think, of what a cancer patient is or should be. So first of all, you've got a firefighter who's a tough guy and macho, but he got felled by cancer when he was actually quite young. And at the same time, you've got a firefighter who plays rock music and has all these tattoos all over him, but reads Cormac McCarthy. And he's just a great person, and he blows away so many stereotypes that people might have about what cancer patients are like. They're noble, they're saints, they're beaten down, they're whatever. This guy is himself, and he stayed himself through cancer and treatment. And the great thing is, he not only is well now, but he is back to fighting fires, which I think is amazing.
He had one objection to your manuscript. He wanted the pseudonym for him and his wife to be Sid and Nancy, after Sid Vicious,
yes.
Nancy Spungen of Sex Pistols fame.
Yes, they are Sex Pistols fans.
Well, let's talk about it. Something that people think a lot about if they think about what goes on behind the scenes at a hospital, and you've written about this before this book, is the relationship between the nurses and the doctors and the hierarchy, explicit and implicit. Talk about relationships between those two parts of the hospital staff.
Right. The best doctor-nurse relationships are when we look at each other as colleagues and treat each other as colleagues. And when that happens, patients get the best care. Unfortunately, there's a history in medicine of not always taking nurses seriously, not always listening to what we have to say, and that can mean that really important things that are going on with patients don't get brought to the doctor's attention because, as I already said, we're the one who's there looking after the patient, seeing them over that 12 hours, not the MD. So it's incredibly frustrating to nurses when we have what to us seems a very important observation about a patient, and we just can't get the doctor to listen to us, or worse, we're treated in a way that's insulting or demeaning with kind of an attitude of, I just don't have time for you because nothing you're going to say is going to be worthwhile to me. It's just a completely mistaken idea about how our professional relationship needs to work. The good news is the new interns and residents we see coming in seem to have very little of that old school attitude of, I'm the doctor and I'm going to be doctor last name and you're going to be nurse first name and I'm going to always be more important than you. I mean, they say, hi, I'm Bob or I'm Marie, and they tend to talk to us much more like people who are working together.
We're talking to registered nurse Teresa Brown. Her new book is The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. You can join in now at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences. If you're a nurse, what do you love about the job? What frustrates you about it? Or if you have questions about what it's like to do this kind of work, give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the profession of nursing. Our guest is Teresa Brown, registered nurse and author of The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about what it's like to work as a nurse, or a story about a nurse who made a difference in your life? If you are a nurse, what do you wish people knew about your line of work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Teresa, your job, your profession has been represented a lot in pop culture. Grey's Anatomy, ER, movies, Scrubs, all those things. Is there something that consistently irritates you about how the profession of nursing is portrayed?
Yes, well, I would say what consistently irritates me is how rarely the profession of nursing is portrayed, and what's much more typical is that you see hospitals where all the work of the hospital is done by doctors, and doctors are doing work that nurses actually do in hospitals. My favorite is always when a doctor will come into a room and sort of lovingly look at an IV that's dripping into a patient's arm, and I have never in my life seen an MD do that, because setting up and running and checking IVs is nurses' work, and we're the ones who do that. And the one time I had an IV pump beeping uncontrollably and I couldn't get in there, the doctor in the room just turned the pump off and then didn't tell me. Hmm. So it really messed up a treatment plan for a patient. I would really, really like it if these shows would show nurses doing the jobs that we do, doctors doing their work and us doing our work. And it doesn't seem like too much to ask.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Randy is on the line in Sauk County. Randy, hi.
Yeah, hi, ma'am. You seem very competent, very sincere, and somebody that would not do what I'm going to tell you happened to me. I needed surgery, and a specialist that I worked with at the UW-Madison referred me to a place to get the surgery, and a nurse, kind of a chief nurse, we were ready to just go, and she sat us down and said, "You need to change your direction. I know what's going to happen," and she so frightened us. Originally, I said, no, stay with the specialist recommendation. Bottom line is, she kept coming at us, and I reluctantly changed my mind and allowed the surgery that she almost demanded, and it was nothing but terror for me. It was took several years to go back and get the correct surgery, and I've often thought, I love nurses and so on, but is it possible that in that exchange of great respect, there could be occasionally a nurse step way out of their role and think they know something they do not know?
Randy, thanks a lot for the call. Sorry about that experience. Hope ultimately everything worked out okay for you. That sounds like something that might happen very rarely, Teresa.
I think so. I agree with you, though. There are definitely nurses that overstep their bounds. There are people in all jobs who don't do their jobs the way that they should. I'm guessing a nurse who acted like that maybe because she has seen physicians recommend surgery when it really, really is not a good idea and perhaps took that idea and ran with it. But I would say her behavior was inappropriate, to use an overused word, and really also not good nursing, because what we're supposed to be doing is helping patients make decisions, not tell them what we think their decisions should be. And if that happens to other listeners, I would suggest going to the doctor and talking it over, finding the boss of that nurse and talking the situation over. Let them know, if you feel like it, that that happened, because it shouldn't happen, and I'm awfully sorry that it did.
Go back to our callers at 800-642-1234 with Mansi in Germantown. Hi.
Hello. I just like to add, as a nurse, and I work in a long-term care where per Wisconsin law, you know, the doctor is only required to visit the residents or patients every 3 months. In specifically in a long-term care, the nurse plays a vital role in residents' life because they are seeing them on an everyday basis. We are the first one to pick up any changes. And when doctor does not listen to the changes that the nurses has been observing, it takes a toll in patients' life.
Mansi, thanks for that call. Teresa?
That was so well said. I don't think I can even add to it, but thank you for pointing out how even more important the nurse is in long-term care, because the doctors come in so infrequently. And I hope people with loved ones in nursing homes know that, know how infrequently MDs are there, and can encourage the MDs to listen to the nurses, because we are the canary in the coal mine for your loved one in that home.
Mansi, thank you so much for the call. We're talking to Teresa Brown, registered nurse. Her new book is The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or your experiences maybe as a nurse yourself. Teresa, one thing that I came across in your book and I've witnessed in person that I don't really think about when it comes to the job of a nurse is the physical side of it. Sometimes you are, you know, as in the book, I help just escorting someone to the restroom, very worried about about falls. They might be much larger than you. How big a part of your job is just that sheer physicality?
It's a bigger part than you would think because it always creates anxiety. Every nurse knows of at least one nurse who had to quit working at the bedside because of a back injury. It's so universal that we all are afraid of it. So anytime you have to move someone, unless they weigh 80 pounds and are very spry, it creates stress. And I can remember having these ridiculous scenarios once with a patient who was just really, really tall. He was over 6 feet tall, and we were trying to move him from his bed to a special kind of chair to work on his breathing, and we got him halfway there and got him stuck and then had to bring in more people. And I mean, I felt like such an idiot, but he was actually very gracious about it. But it can be awkward for patients to be moved around and really difficult for nurses because, you know, patients are getting bigger and bigger. This guy wasn't overweight. He was just very, very tall and a very solid person. So it's challenging.
Teresa, if you could change one thing about how we deliver healthcare in hospitals and wards like the ones you worked at, what would you want us to change?
I would love it if we could spend less time on the computer and more time with patients. Electronic health records were supposed to make us all more efficient and coordinate care better, but instead they've just become a way for people to record every single possible detail about a patient that could be recorded. And so not just nurses, but physicians, physical therapists, respiratory therapists, dietary people, all are finding we spend more and more time documenting details about the patients instead of being with them. And that it does not feel like the right use of our time.
Teresa, you went from being a writer, which you still do, and an English instructor to a nurse. What would you say to someone who isn't in nursing, but thinking, maybe that's my calling, maybe that's what I'd want to do? How would you encourage them? How would you encourage them?
I would encourage them. And when my first book came out, it was about my first year of being a nurse, and I wrote about that. I used to teach English in college, had kids, really changed what I wanted from a job, had a friend who's a nurse who clued me into the fact that I could actually become a nurse, and that was it. I was hooked, and I did it, and I had a number of people write to me after Critical Care came out saying, you know, I also have a PhD in English, and now I'm becoming a nurse, or I was a professional dancer, and now I'm becoming a nurse. I was on Wall Street making a lot of money, and now I'm becoming a nurse. So it was really great to hear all these very motivated people say that my example had made them feel more normal. And I would say anyone who wants to do it, yeah, it's a hard job. You will not get the respect you deserve, but it is a fabulous, fabulous job. And if you want to do it, go for it.
So despite the hardship, the anxiety, the stress, the back injury, it's a job you love?
It is definitely a job I love, yes. I love being in what we call that in-between space with the patient where we get to be close to them, but then we're also trying to make the system work better to take care of them. We're trying to communicate with physicians about what's the best that we can do for this person, and I just find that aspect of it infinitely rewarding. And whenever the things that get me down are getting me down, invariably I'll then have a patient experience that reminds me, oh, this is why I do this. There's a lot of crap, but the good is so amazing and wonderful that it's completely worth it.
Teresa, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Teresa Brown, registered nurse. Her new book is The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, 4 Patients' Lives. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.